All right, hey guys, and welcome to the Three Drinks In podcast, episode number 208. I am your host, Vince. Over there is your host, Phil.
Hey.
I have to work on this cadence thing. I don't know why I talk like this when I do this intro. In this episode, we are doing a deep dive into a Star Trek The Next Generation episode. This one is The Wounded, which features Colm Meaney in a more forward role than he typically is. Also, Bob Gunton of Shawshank Redemption fame. Before we get into all that, though, I want to remind you that Three Drinks In is available on all streaming services, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and iHeartRadio. Make sure that you subscribe, tell your friends, leave a review. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Three Drinks In Pod. You could like us on Facebook. You could head to our merch store at TeePublic. If you go to the website, there's links to the online store in the description of the podcast. And if you want to email us, you can do so at threedrinksinpodcast@gmail.com. All right.
Doing another podcast where the only ones who actually enjoy it are us.
Yes.
For real.
So it's really just this series of, you know, just awkward, generally masturbatory exercises that are designed to entertain maybe four people on the planet.
Maybe.
And we're here for you, all four of you.
That's pushing it.
And two of us are here.
Yeah.
So you picked this one this time. Usually I tell you, hey, I just watched this one, and it was interesting enough to do a podcast about. So
I think it's a good episode. The basic plot of it goes, a captain of the Starfleet has gone rogue and attacked a group of people known as the Cardassians, because apparently they had a war that they finally finished brokering peace after a year or two. And, you know, they're not allies, but they're uneasy neighbors. And so they send Picard out there and say, something's going on. I think he's attacked people. And they don't know why. So when they finally hunt him down after taking on some Cardassian passengers to sort of help, you know, help them understand the situation, they find out that he lost his family years ago in an attack, and he's been like attacking ships and bases because he thinks that the former enemy is once again arming themselves for war. And they sort of have to like talk him down off the ledge and show him that he's preemptively hurting people and he needs to stop doing that. And that's basically what the plot is.
Yeah. So if you've seen Apocalypse Now,
I always think it's funny when they compare it to Apocalypse Now. I mean, have you ever seen that movie?
Oh yeah. I've read the book too, Heart of Darkness, which I know I think is your favorite book, right?
Well, no, it's a good book. I like it a lot, but even the movie is very different because.
Oh sure.
You know, that movie where Marlon Brando is so insane that, you know, go get him. And they go into the jungle and get that guy.
Yeah, what? So, like, I haven't seen it in a while. Why do they send Willard into the jungle to get Kurtz? He's gone bananas, but he's also, like, taken a village hostage or something, and he's making them worship him like a god.
Yeah, they don't. In the movie, they don't really understand what he's doing because he's so remote. So they send him up there, you know, to figure out what's going on. And if he's gone nuts, then we need you to kill him. And yeah, he gets up there and like they're worshiping him, and he like looks at it as like his own little kingdom.
Yeah, he's definitely, you know, gone over the deep end. It's, you know, it's one of those things where like. Marlon Brando basically was an abused person for most of his life, especially by the people who put him in movies, because he was really not a well person, but he was very compelling to watch, and if properly tormented, could play an insane person very convincingly. And so, like, you know, they kind of put him in front of a camera, and he really had no business being there as far as mental health is concerned. But they filmed it, and it was great. And even if you don't like that movie, which I don't love it, it's kind of its time, you can definitely appreciate how like great Marlon Brando is in it. But it's kind of like Shelley Long in in The Shining. You know, he just drove that poor woman insane for the better end of like 6 months and filmed it, and that's what you get, and it was good. Anyway.
Yeah. I mean, that's the very basic premise of this one, because once they actually, you know, meet the guy, he's not insane. He's just emotionally damaged, you know, like he's not running around with skulls around his neck or anything like that. But I thought it was a really good episode because I think at this point, Gene Roddenberry was either dead or dying and like not well enough to work on the show. And they kind of snuck in that this very extremely intense experience for some of these characters, especially a background character of O'Brien. He was just a bit player that they had every so often. They put him to the fore where he actually knew this captain at some point in the past. You know, they were in a war and fighting and people were dying and they were having trouble coping with it, basically. You know, like you could still take away all the Star Trek parts and still have a very good story of people trying to come to terms with PTSD and how you react to people who used to be the enemy, but now they're just uneasy neighbors and that kind of thing. It was really interesting that they managed to get away with that in a Star Trek show, which was famous for not having one conflict between characters and two, you know, they're so emotionally well evolved that they don't have these issues.
Yeah.
You know. And so I think that added a nice science fiction flavor to it, you know. And they did this with O'Brien on a DS9 episode. You know you're supposed to be a more evolved person, and yet you're still grappling with the same problems as anybody in universal history, you know. When you kill a person, when you lose a person, you know, and you're sitting there going, well, I'm from the 24th century, and I'm supposed to be evolved, and I'm supposed to be handling this better. And yet I'm not.
Yeah, I mean, that always made, I thought, you know, for a really interesting commentary. So like the episode that you're referencing in DS9 is Hard Time, when they put him through like prison. They give him 20 years worth of prison memories in 5 minutes. It's, you know, it's almost like an excuse to put your character through some kind of mental torture. And yeah, I mean, that's basically where DS9 was successful, and Enterprise to a certain degree too. No, not even and Enterprise. So DS9 and Enterprise took this idea, and they really did something interesting with it. Like, rather than rebel against Gene Roddenberry and just start, you know, making a show like, you know, Battlestar Galactica and really going off the rails, they were like, okay, fine. If you set up all these rules where everyone's got to be nice and everyone's got to be evolved and everyone's got to, you know, not have a complicated, dramatic backstory, besides like Troy, who's just kind of like weird and home and like lovesick off and on, her and Riker, which is completely uninteresting. They're like, fine, well, let's take away things bit by bit and see how they react to them. You know, you put O'Brien through various war scenarios. You put Sisko on a space station, you know, at the edge of the, you know, of civilization, and make him, you know, have to, you know, force him to play the, you know, the superintendent and make everyone get along. And like, you know, and Sisko has a whole speech where he says the problem is Earth. On Earth, everything's a paradise. Everything works. Everything's great. Everyone gets along because there's no reason to not fight. To fight, because there's nothing to fight about. It's different out here. And in Enterprise, they're at the beginning of that. So like they're not quite so evolved, and Archer really struggles with things. And bit by bit, you do it in reverse. So they start off like that versus ending up like that. Like, so like they start off kind of rough and tumble, and they learn how to adapt to meeting new people and how not to run around with their dicks out, just telling everyone what to do. And that's where you get the episode Cogenitor, when Trip gets that porter being killed. It's literally the process in reverse, where they learn to be more restrained and they learn to play a more evolved role, because they recognize there's, you know, that the episode would, when Archer's trying to get the Tellarites and the Andorians to cooperate. It's like, just behave like us and you'll be fine. Like, we have managed to find a balance between all these things, and all you people, you know, it's almost like a funny side joke. Like, you know, everyone's got one overextended personality trait, except for us. We're pretty even keel.
You know?
And Shram gets all, like, insulted. It's kind of a funny thing. But so they're approaching it from the other way. They start off rough and kind of gritty, and then they end up becoming more refined as the show goes on. They fit in, and then they build the Federation. And then fast forward 300 years, and you keep expanding and expanding, and you've got this bloated giant empire, and you find that it's harder to hold on to your humanity as you encounter just more insane things. And nothing gets more insane than the Dominion and the kind of insane stuff that goes on with them. And then you have Voyager, which didn't bother to do any of that. they pretended that we were on our own little universe on that ship and fly around, and you're nuts, and like, yeah.
Yeah, as an English teacher who teaches students with, you know, classic novels and things like that, I mean, the point of a lot of those things is so you hold up the characters in these books to yourself and to humanity and say, what would you do? Because in a book, you have like extreme examples of things. People get murdered and adultery and all these things. And this is one of those few episodes of, especially The Next Generation, where you can do that. Because the problem with the characters on The Next Generation is they're not exploring their inner lives and things like that. That happened on Deep Space Nine. It was more interesting that way. The Next Generation and Voyager were shows about what's a weird sci-fi concept we can understand and explore. You know, like this one doesn't have any of those things. We're not getting sucked into a wormhole, or we're not in a time loop. It's not that kind of show. So when this one takes its time to slow down and say, you know, people are supposed to be enlightened and evolved, you can look at it and say, well, I know my own self, like as the viewer, how would I react if a guy who used to be my enemy, if a Nazi German soldier wants to sit down with a Jewish person after the Holocaust is over and have a beer with him, you know, how would I react to that? And then in the back of your mind, you're sitting there going, I know I'm supposed to be the bigger man. Would I really be in that situation? I mean, on Star Trek, that's not something they normally talk about. But what made it such an interesting episode was that you as the person can see yourself in that, even though the guy's wearing ridiculous prosthetic makeup on his forehead or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. It's what made O'Brien so interesting versus like Geordi LaForge, who just had a thing on his face, like a hair barrette.
Poor Geordi.
Poor Geordi.
They didn't know what to do with him. They really had no idea.
No. I mean, when you watch the show, like, who's a character that stands out? O'Brien, Barclay, you know?
Yeah.
You know, those kinds of characters stand out more because they had inner lives and personalities that were not bland, generic, uniform-wearing people. Like
Worf, too. Worf was very much.
Worf, absolutely.
Yeah.
But like,
the rest of them, like
Crusher?
Nothing. You know, Picard did because they always hinted that he was some kind of a badass when he was younger.
And well, he gets a lot of screen time, so you have to fill that, you know.
Yeah.
Like, how many episodes was Troy really in that wasn't about her mother?
Yeah.
And it's not the actor's fault. I'm just saying that's how they were written. So.
Yeah, no, they didn't. Yeah, no, it wasn't them at all.
Yeah, and the more interesting guest stars. So, you know, Bob Gunton was the captain in this one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he walks in smiling, yelling, you know, upset. He has an emotional, teary speech. He was a fantastic guest star in this.
Yeah, he was really good. He's good in everything, though.
Oh, for sure.
One of the interesting things, I was talking to my wife about this before we started recording, because I rewatched this today on my lunch break, and I was looking at it, and I had a very interesting experience in that, like, I usually kind of watch these things again and kind of go, yep, that happened, and yep, that happened, and it wasn't that good, and okay, fine. Like, I'm not sort of surprised by it, But this one is a little bit more complex emotionally, and I found myself having sort of a different, like, you know, when you go back and you read a book for like the third time, and you go, oh, I never thought of it from that angle before. One of the things that struck me was that, like, it's kind of a, it's not like an anti-hero story, but it's an anti-heroic story in some ways. So this is the introduction of the Cardassians, and this creates a lot of good problems for the show and the characters, and a lot of sticky ones for the show and the characters. So, like, you're told in the first few minutes, like, this, we used to be at war. Well, we've never heard of them, and this is the fourth season of the show.
Yeah, so, I was going to get to that.
Yeah, we kind of have to retcon this a tad. He even, you know, mentions that, like, you know, Picard does, like, you know, when I was on the Stargazer, which was a while ago, you know, I got into, so, like, if you think about it a little bit, you, well, this seems a little bit awkward in terms of the structure of everything. And there's a little, like, that's the sort of big part about this, where, you're, like, you're introducing a new villain, a formidable villain, with whom your characters have a history, but you've never heard of them before. And that's a little bit hard to do. And there's, you can get into the real nitty-gritty, like, you know, how did Chief O'Brien go from being the tactical officer on a starship to the transporter guy?
I mean, like, just stands in the transporter.
Did he sleep
room
with somebody's wife? What did he do?
Yeah.
You know, that was sort of a...
He accidentally phasered a puppy or something.
Opened an airlock with somebody. Oh, my God.
I know.
So... That, you know, but like that kind of nitpicky stuff is, you know, you could, fine. Like, I don't really care. You know, being the tactical officer on the Rutledge may be akin to being the transporter chief on the flagship. Who the hell knows? So I have no idea. But so there's a couple of things about this. I'm only looking at have my notes. So yeah, it's sort of the anti-heroic, because so Picard's job is to avoid war at all costs, because they're kind of afraid of going through that again. And they just got over the thing with the Borg, and they're not ready to have a conflict with the Cardassians again. But at the same time, they really don't give the other guy any benefit of the doubt. So if you think about it, you've got a decorated, highly decorated, well-known, popular, beloved captain in Bob Gunton's character, who's done a pretty terrible thing. And they're like, you know, find out what's going on. It looks really fishy. We're not quite sure. But there are people who go into Picard's office and tell him insane shit all the time. And he's like, well, I believe you. We have to get to the bottom of this. Like, they don't give this guy an inch. Like, they're convinced he's done something wrong before they even meet him. And Picard's running around talking about this, and they kind of latch on to the family tragedy thing pretty early. But they're just very suspicious of him right away, and they seem to be giving the Cardassians the benefit of the doubt, for, you know, guardedly. But for the most part, they're like, listen, we're trying really hard on not to get into a fight. You can see that. I can see that. Please don't punch me in the face. Like, they're very... That's like their main goal. And this becomes a theme with the Cardassians for the rest of Next Generation. And it kind of becomes a problem. It becomes a problem because it makes things awkward for the characters when you get to season 7 and you got the Indians on that planet in the middle of nowhere, and it changes hands when they form the demilitarized zone. It, you know, Picard has to relocate forcibly a group of Indians in the 24th century. It creates problems when they make the Maquis, who become kind of a nuisance and not that interesting character-wise for both Next Generation and DS9. And it creates problems down the line when they want to make action movies with these characters, and they've set up a whole bunch of stories about how they behave a certain way, and then you make Star Trek Insurrection, and they go, remember that whole thing about the... Yeah, no, forget that. We're going to do our own thing now. So... this felt more like a Picard story to me at this viewing, really, because I was thinking about all the ways in which this particular theme with the Cardassians gets played out in lots of different ways in later episodes. And as a bottle show, it's great. As a, you know, the first of a series of shows that involve the relationships between the Cardassians and the Federation, it sort of sets the stage for the Federation to be ultimately very afraid of the Cardassians, which is not something that's ridiculous to think, but it is a little bit when you think about how easily they get, they seem to have a lot of, they're more advanced than them technologically, and it's odd for our characters to seem to be basically afraid of getting into a fight with people who are clearly kind of slippery and not very trustworthy.
That's funny, because like that does happen, but I think it's because, so like I was, when I read all the behind the scenes stuff, and they said like we had to come up with someone new because we had done Klingons and we had done Romulans to death at that point. And they always looked at the Romulans like not the Soviet Empire at that point, though. There wasn't one, but they were looking at them like Russia or some other giant nation where they're so huge that any kind of conflict between us would be a problem, even though we know they're up to no good. You know, I mean, the Romulans were always the adversaries. No one liked the Romulans. And so you would also avoid trying to do any sort of fight with that. Whereas the Cardassians were supposed to be like overly aggressive, rage-filled characters. And of course, Mark Alamo didn't want to play it that way. You know, he plays the head Cardassian here, and he played the main antagonist of Deep Space Nine. He played another Cardassian.
Is that what it was? He preferred to play him quiet and kind of like, you know, eerily terrifying.
Yeah, like he looked at the script and said, "I'm clearly sneaking around here, so I'm going to play it cool. Like I'm not going to, you know, be caught with anything. Like more of a Romulan type plot, but." The Federation people looked at the Cardassians as like they're on a hair trigger. And if we upset them in any way, it won't just be like they attack a ship. It'll be like they start bombing everything. Like it would be a serious problem. And so that's why they kind of looked at it like, make sure you don't do anything that could start a whole nother war. So
interesting. I actually think that Mark Lemo was right. And he's he was nuts. Right. He's a lunatic. Seems like a nice guy, but he, you know, you watch him in interviews and he's an unusual fella.
Yeah. Well, you know, usually you get these kind of actors that they do a good job of looking at what they're supposed to be doing and playing it right like that. Like the guy who played Garrick was the same way.
Yeah. It was a character.
You know, I looked at it like, yeah, like, well, what is it I'm supposed to be doing? And then like, well, you want to be like this. And he'll look at the material and be like, but that's not what I'm like, what I'm saying is not what I'm doing. Like,
yeah,
a good actor will figure that stuff out.
And I mean, in my mind, unquestionably the most interesting villain race that the show ever produced. And because they developed them such a rich, you know, history in the terms of like they take a little bit of everything. They take a little bit of, you know, the Soviet Union. They take a little bit of National Socialism, you know, in the early to mid 20th century, and they kind of combine all that into one horrifying enemy that is basically just the state. That's their thing. Is like and they play it that both for horror and for laughs. I mean, I love Garrick and the Doctor's discussions of Cardassian literature, the repetitive epic, as being a type of novel, and it's supposed to be like, and Bashir's like, just the same thing happens for 400 pages. This one was born, he serves the state honorably, then he dies, then his son does the same thing, and then you're up to like the ninth grandkid. He's like, well, this is the whole point. It's elegant and marvelous, and this is what everyone should be doing. I'm like, it's just propaganda, people. But like, you know, that was, you know, the Dominion was probably a more exciting enemy, but as far as complexity goes, you know, between everything going on with the Cardassians and Bajor, and then the Cardassians with the Dominion, they were just so interesting, and you know, both in their highs and their lows, and you know, they had, whereas the Romulans were just, they never did anything with the Romulans. they were just basically liars all the time. Like, there was never anything good that came out of them. There was, like, that one episode with all the Latin in it where Bashir goes to Romulus for, like, a medical conference during the war, and Section 40, 31 is there, and fine. Like, that was okay. But they're not interesting characters. They have no personalities. The Cardassians are nothing but personality. In this one, it was slow going. You know, he's playing a very, you know, subdued character, but
it's always tough when you first introduce a new alien, because like when they beam over and they're wearing those headsets,
yeah,
you're sitting here going, what's the point of that? Because they never wear them the rest of the episode, and they never wear them again ever on the series. But you know,
I literally wrote that like why do they have these things? And like, the thing about the Cardassians, and I really think that, I guess it was Michael Westmore was the guy who was doing the makeup. Their makeup design was pretty good in this for a first shot at it. Like, they had facial hair, which was not necessary. And by the time you get to later episodes, you know, you have Dukat, who really was just resplendent in that makeup. He really made it move. It was great. And like, the thing about their costumes was that it showed off a lot of the shoulder and the neck, so it had to move and it had to not tear when he was wearing it, and it just looked great. It was really great. But like, you look alien enough with that. You don't need to put a thing on their head, like a weirdo hat. That was kind of a this bit of gilding the lily, as they say.
Yeah. I think this is, well, do we have any more to say on that, or?
No, I just, but I don't know. I just thought it was interesting that I'm watching it for like the 400th time or something like that. I had a different experience with it. I was like, oh yeah. Like, they're really just assuming Captain Maxwell, you know, they assume he's wrong. And that he's crazy, and that they're not really way off base. But if you have someone who was a trusted and decorated officer who served for years, why would your first thought be that he's nuts and the Cardassians are probably telling us the truth? That seems like, you know, they seem hell-bent on figuring out why he's done this horrible thing, not what horrible thing did the Cardassians do that made you do this? And even at the end,
he's vindicated at the end. They kind of admit, like, yeah, he was probably right. I mean, you know.
But he is and he isn't. Like, they deplore his methods, and like, they, you know, and Picard turns to Gul Masset and says, you know, we'll be watching you, and, you know, and that's giving a nod to it, but I don't know.
My note was like, this is the least like TOS that you can be at this point. Like, this is as far from that as they've gone. And that's what you said basically before, was that, you know, Roddenberry was not as involved with the show's production at this point, so they could get away with making interesting shows about O'Brien and his relationship with the Cardassians and with himself. Because he has that great scene with his wife, which I think is really just great, where he's like, you know, I think other people really don't like the Cardassians. Meanwhile, he was a dick like 20 minutes ago.
Yeah, war's over. What's the big deal?
Yeah, you know, in the elevator, not two scenes ago, he was being a total asshole. And so, like, it's just a great scene. And I lost my train of thought there for a second. But yeah, so it's less Roddenberry because of that thing, but it's also less Roddenberry because Kirk wouldn't have gone, you know, this captain's gone mad. He'd been like, well, I wonder why he did that. You know, that kind of take charge, very go get him, you know, swashbuckly kind of Captain Kirk would have been like, well, he must have had a reason for killing all these people. We should probably find out what it is. And it turns out that he doesn't have a good one. So, like, I guess what I kind of maybe would have wanted to see was, like, them looking to
to Captain Maxwell to go, okay, well, like, what do you know? And he's like, I don't know anything. And then it gets creepy. But they assume they have that. What?
They have that scene. Picard grills him.
Yeah, but he does. So, but there's no change in Picard. If Picard has that scene with him where he's like, Captain, we're sure you have a good reason for doing this. What is it? And he comes up with a bunch of, like, you know, half answers and nonsense. But that's not how that scene plays out. He gets there and he's cold. He's very cold to him. And he's just like, why have you done this? This is terrible. He begins with the conversation by saying, we think you've screwed this up. He doesn't begin it like, okay, what's your, you know, what kind of information can you give us that would, you know, like, he doesn't begin the conversation by saying, help me help you explain this to people. He's like, you screwed this up. Why did you do that? So they begin in an adversarial kind of way. They didn't begin in a kind of, you know, like, it doesn't give Picard anywhere to go with it. If the meeting begins like, please tell me what you know so we can figure out how to deal with the Cardassians, and then he finds out that he has nothing, that it's just information comes my way, and it's just kind of a hunch, and why would they be doing this? And then then it's kind of horrifying, like, oh my God, you just killed a bunch of people, like 700 people, on a hunch? That's not how we operate here. Then you kind of, you know, but that's not what happens. So I don't know. That's what I took out of it this time. Because, you know, then it comes, you know, just it comes up later where Picard is put in awkward positions where he's helping the Cardassians all the time. You know, he does it with the Indians. He does it with Ensign Ro, who's constantly fighting against the humans because he's following orders from the Federation Council, and they're the ones that, you know, he adheres to everything that they say, whereas, like, Sisko wouldn't do that. Sisko's much more a man on the ground, even when he's chasing down Eddington. You know, he's still, like, you know, he has his own personal vendetta with that. It's not about, you know, what the Federation Council wants him to do, or Starfleet Command kind of thing.
Yeah, I guess because, like, when they tell him to go get him, and they tell Picard, you know, he's attacked this group, and he goes, why? And the Admiral says, we have no idea. He won't answer us, you know? And then even when they're chasing after him, he won't answer them. And it's not until they're, like, basically on top of his ship that he beams over. And then he starts, because they're like, that's why Picard was like, I don't understand what you're doing here. And he goes, oh, well, the enemy's this, the enemy's that. And that's why he goes, well, where's your proof? You know, where's the paperwork? Where's this? Where's that? And he doesn't try to, like, explain anything to him. He gets, like, upset.
Yeah.
And he starts, you know, you don't understand. And that's when Picard just goes, okay, well, we're you
know. Okay.
Yeah, we're dealing with something here. Because then they spoke to O'Brien, and he said, you know, he lost his family. And he goes, you know, Picard puts two and two together. So I don't know.
I forgot about the fact that they were trying to get a hold of him and they couldn't. But then again, like, you know, that kind of thing can be explained. You know, it just, there was no sense of, like, no one ever says, well, maybe, you know, they're jamming his transmissions. Maybe this, maybe that. They never give the guy the benefit of the doubt. And turns out they shouldn't have, because he was, you know, clearly not well. You know, and they handle it well at the end. I mean, Picard's speech to Ducat, Masset, whatever his name is.
Good. First time he did that.
Yeah.
I mean, he's basically the same.
It's exactly the same character.
Same affect
for the most
and everything.
But, like, his speech to him at the end was just like, hang on a minute. Like, we can feel bad for him, but we can't dismiss him. Like, it's not. So. But.
I think it's funny that this is one of those few episodes that is better that they don't have any special effects. you know.
Yeah, that. Oh my God.
They're always talking about like the space battles that you never ever see, and it can be frustrating. But in this one, it's okay.
Not only is it okay, it's fantastic. Like, yes, the battles in DS9 are great. You know, the people who write for, you know, Discovery should maybe take a page out of that fucking book. Because, like, oh, look, I can see everything. That's why it's a television show. But, like, this one where they're just staring at the video game screen on the thing. It's just two dots flying around.
And then, like,
but,
like, that just goes... Poof,
boom,
and like fades out, and you're like, oh my God, 600 people just died or whatever.
Like, it literally has, like, you know, in 1980s, wow, like, just gonna just, it's like playing Pac-Man. It has that weird goofy sound effect. I'm like, do we need the sound effect there? Like, I guess so.
we do. Okay. I suppose you know what you're doing.
What do we have for that sound effect, Bob? But, like, yeah, it's so much more. It's so much more tense because they're kind of watching it and they can't do anything about it. Like, that's the thing that I think is great. And, like, they can't do anything about it. Like, one of the great things about sort of like more science-based science fiction, like The Martian, which is a movie I really like, but it's like, it's one of those like low stakes movies. It's just kind of fun. There's a bit at the end when they're gonna go rescue the guy off the surface of Mars, where they the Kristen Wiig character turns to Chitwil Yujifor, or however you say his name, and says, like, okay, so what can we do to help them from here? He's like, nothing, because it takes, you know, so many light minutes for like the radio signal to get to us, and they get back like, and that's a thing that makes science fiction that doesn't have subspace really tense, is that, like, you can't talk to people who are really far away, because people are really far away. The Expanse is good for this too. Like, you can't have instant conversations with people. It makes it so, like, that sense of impotence and not being able to you know, affect change in situations that you're watching from afar, that can create a lot of drama, and they use that here very effectively. And, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, this is so much better than, like, giant things blowing up in space. And, you know, it's just so much better than that crap. So.
But you're right, like, because I was thinking of, there's a DS9 episode. It's the end of the third season where the shapeshifter gets on the Defiant. And he's commandeered it, and they're sending it to some space.
Zenkithi space.
Where they have the Zenkithi.
Another war we didn't know about.
They had a whole war with this race of aliens we've never seen or heard about before. And it's just like, what is this coming from? So when they say, like, the Cardassian War, I'm just like, all right, sure. I mean, they did that with all of them. The Romulan War was the same way in the original series. And that one was the dumbest because no one had ever seen a Romulan during that war.
Oh, yeah. That's
and
true.
This was a thing in Enterprise. So, like, when they deal with the Romulans on Enterprise, they never see them. They only ever hear them because apparently they said that, like, there was a huge war with the Romulans. Somehow we never saw what they looked like until, like, much later after the war was over. So, like, that they didn't think that one through either.
It's a cool concept. I mean, I remember that scene where they, you know, where they find the Romulan minefield, and you know, they see the ship decloak, which is the first time that they've ever seen it. Like, I think that's the first time that they've seen a cloaking device. Did the Klingons have them at that point? I forget.
I don't think so.
So this thing just appears out of nowhere, which is crazy, and I forgot they've never actually and when they do the whole season 4 plot where the Romulans try and take over, or they try to, you know, cause, you know, discord between the various species, then we see them as the audience, but they never see them.
But they don't see them. They hear them, but that's about it. You know,
yeah.
Talk on the intercom and stuff.
Yeah. So Yeah.
I thought it was good. And you just, and it was, you know, you started seeing O'Brien as Colin Meaney is a great, as a great actor.
It's a great actor.
You know, and this, they hadn't really thought much about, like, he's still wearing the pips on the collar, you know, but he did a good job. It was, it's great to see those side characters so rarely on The Next Generation get a chance to shine.
Yeah, there were really, what, there was two. There was him and there was Barkley. Was there a third?
That recurred? I mean, not often. There were one-offs every so often, but...
Yeah, I mean, there was a few people who kind of played minor characters that had, like, non-speaking roles, or, like, an icer, like the woman that ran the helm.
Yeah,
there was
a
black
lady
that did that for years, and, you know, she...
I mean, I guess Whoopi Goldberg would be the next one.
No,
up the
that
tier.
was I don't really count that one because, I mean, she was famous already. Like, that was the thing. Like, she was a famous comedian slash actress already, and, you know, like LeVar Burton, they found Star Trek to be a powerful influence on them because of the racial component, the fact that there was, you know, that Roddenberry seemed not to care too much about skin color, and so he was happy to, you know, he wanted to have this positive vision for the future, and whether he really believed that or not, he was committed to the fictional idea that that's how things were going to end up, and so they really appreciated that, and they sought out the job from him when they found out that he was rebooting the show, and they all thought that Nichelle Nichols was a really important character and, you know, cultural touchstone for them personally. So I don't really count Whoopi Goldberg because, like, she both was eager to do it, but also, like, I'm doing you a favor by playing this crazy weirdo character for you, and we both get something out of this, is kind of what I've always, like, the vibe that I've always gotten about her involvement in the show. You know, they said, like, we would have her for, like, 2 weeks during a year. And so they would film, and you usually kind of film not necessarily in sequence, but you film one episode after the other, and sometimes it just, you're there for 12 hours a day. You know, if you finish one episode at hour six, you just pick up with the next one. They get to give you a new, you know, script, and you kind of go for it, which is a terrible way to do anything. But with her, it was like, no, we're going to film all of her scenes from, like, Monday to next Thursday, and that's it. So it was a little bit different, but, like, Colin Meaney was just a struggling Irish actor, you know, and I can't think of a guy who played Reg Barkley.
Dwight Schultz.
Dwight Schultz. I'm like, Duncan and something? No. But, yeah, he was on the A-team, and I'm sure he had other things he did, but, you know, I don't know what they were. You know, these were still working character actors, and... yeah, so it's, and then I think DS9 had a lot more recurring because they could. Yeah. The situation allowed for it, which was sort of hard about this.
They had as many recurring characters as these shows had main characters.
Oh, yeah.
Like, their cast was just twice as huge because they had so many people keep coming back.
And, like, I mean, part of that is just the design of the show. Like, you, if you're on a ship, it's still relatively small, you know, like something about always, like, the visual presentation of Deep Space Nine was always kind of hard for me. Like, they kept saying how large a place it was. And I never really got that exactly. Like, yeah, the Enterprise would fly in and the Enterprise would be really, really small next to them. But, like, the design of DS9 really did not give you a sense of its scale. And when you first see it, it's, you know, it's an orbit of Bajor, which is a planet, so it's freaking huge, and so it looks small there. It never looked as large, like,
no,
whatever.
They only ever went to, like, four places.
Well, right,
there's,
but, like,
there's Quarks, there's the Promenade, there's Ops, and then there's the hallway, and the hallway looked the same everywhere.
Yeah, so, like, it's difficult to get a sense of scale, but at the same time, there's that one. I guess it was Star Trek, the motion picture, where they fly into that space station. And, like, the guys on Red Letter Media were talking about this at some point, where they didn't bother to screw with the scale. Like, they just reused a shot from the motion picture where the Enterprise A, whatever, flies into this thing, it's like a third the size of the Enterprise D. And so when the Enterprise D flies in, it's just like, oh, that door got bigger, I guess. So just not a, but that thing looks monstrous because of the way it was designed. That sort of like, you know, it looked kind of like a giant jellyfish, like a giant metal jellyfish floating in space. This huge thing. You get a real sense of how large it is. It's absolutely massive. DS9 doesn't feel that big because it's mostly open space. You know, the pylons and like the kind of like claw, it's a cool design, but like that circular clawy nature, which was definitely alien and worked for the show, doesn't really give you a sense of how big it is because it's most of it's empty space. It's not actually there. So the idea is that the rings themselves are massive enough to accommodate several thousand people living there full time. But
yeah, but I mean, you know, the Enterprise was supposed to have 1,000 people living on it with children, like families were supposed to be, but they never showed them. That's why they were so shocked that they had success with that one episode with like the lower decks with the people who were just like the ensigns and stuff. Oh. Did the whole episode focusing on them. And people loved that episode. And they were like, oh, I wonder why. I'm like, because here's people with different motivations for once. Like the ensign who wants to get ahead and like the gossipy waiter and the girl trying to prove herself. I mean, the main characters don't do any of that stuff. So it was interesting to watch.
Yeah, it's called personality.
Imagine that.
Yeah, seriously. But this is an early gem. It's just such, and you know, it gave us more Cal Meany, who ended up really, really being the best part, I think, of DS9. You know, easily.
And it introduced one of the better villains, which was good.
Yes, absolutely.
So watch this one.
Yeah, you should definitely check this one out. We recommend this one. As we say. And if you guys have any thoughts about The Wounded or want to suggest us to talk about other episodes of Next Generation or really any of them, you know, we'd love to take audience suggestions for episodes that we could do deep dives on to see if we have similar ideas about them. You should let us know on Twitter and Instagram. We are at Three Drinks in Pod. Make sure that you subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or iHeartRadio, leave reviews or just a rating. That's all we really need is a rating. Check out the merch, which you can find the link to on the website. There's the Facebook, there's the email, you know everything now. That it?
Yeah, that's it.
Okie dokie. As always, please drink. I think I've been drinking too much. I haven't had a drop. Please drink responsibly, and we'll talk to you all next time.
Yeah, take care.
Bye.
What was that song of his? One he always sang, one I liked. The minstrel boy to the war has gone. In the ranks of death you will find him. His father's sword he hath girded on, and his wild harp's love behind him. Land of song, said the warrior bard, though all the world betrays thee, one sword at least thy rights shall guard, one faithful harp shall praise thee.